This is White Collared, the podcast, season one, episode two, Threads. My name is Eric Alton Glenn Hilliard, and I would like to welcome you to this episode of the podcast. Now, if you're listening to this shortly after it is released, I am recording several weeks in advance of the official launch of the podcast. I am trying to build up a stock of episodes so that I can get off to a good start and allow myself some time to deal with any issues that may crop up here at the beginning of the production. What this means is that if you've listened to the first episode and have been kind enough to leave a comment somewhere or to send me an email or leave a review, I'm already several episodes ahead in my recording, so I will not be able to acknowledge your comments on the podcast for a little while. But please be certain I am tracking the comments and feedback and reviews as best I can as they are available to me. And I certainly do appreciate the support. So let's get into it. This is the first regular production episode of the series. This episode first aired on October 30th, 2009, was written by Clifton Campbell and was directed by Denny Gordon. It's Fashion Week. The city's turned upside down when a multitude of models and buyers flood the city. Neil enjoys the presence of the beautiful women. Peter doesn't care about the female scenery. He is just frustrated at the disruption to his normality. Things get worse when a model is witness to a murder apparently committed by the notorious Israeli counterfeiter Govat, the ghost. They soon learn that the stakes are even higher than the murder. Meanwhile, Neil is convinced that Kate must have left him a message during their final prison meeting, and he desperately seeks a way to learn what that message might have been. Things begin with Peter and Neil on the street trying to catch a cab. They are supposed to be on their way to interview a witness, but they're having trouble getting a cab. They get cabs flagged down, but every time they try to get in, models come along and get into the cab before them. So it's very frustrating to Peter, who, as we previously discussed, likes things neat, orderly, and by the book. And Fashion Week is anything but neat, orderly, and by the book for him. Neil seems to be enjoying it, but he is going to be thrown out of his element as well very quickly. At the start of the episode, he does not realize that they are going to be going after Govat, and he certainly doesn't realize that what is the motivation for this investigation is a murder and not just a simple white-collar crime. Neil states that Govat is notorious. He's a counterfeiter of treasury bonds, dollars. He's rumored to be the first person to crack the microprinting on the euro. And these are the types of crimes that Neil was brought in to consult on, not murder. But that's where this investigation starts out. Now, the problem is how to identify their suspect. The FBI knows very little about Govat. They don't know his real identity. They have no photographs of him, apparently. No fingerprints, no real information on him. And their only witness can only identify him by his voice. They do have a working theory. That theory is that whatever business Govat is involved in is being somehow tied up into Fashion Week. Neil suggests that maybe the best way to lure him out is to throw a party.
The witness is confident she can identify him by his voice.
How do you know he'll show up?
You fill it with beautiful women.
I was addressing my case agent.
Looking at his MO, he has a thing for models.
Yeah, well, me too. Hey, Jones, you like models?
Love them.
Jones likes them too. Is there a plan in here somewhere? Call me when one shows up.
Hughes is not impressed. He doesn't see a plan in there. And quite frankly, Peter really doesn't see a plan in there either. He does try to defend the plan. He does go to bat for Neil and tells Hughes, look, these guys are cut from the same cloth. Neil's convinced it'll work, but he's not convinced either. The only reason he is really even supporting the plan, why he's submitted it to Hughes as a possibility and he defends it, is because he doesn't have anything else. He doesn't have any other plan that he can come up with, and he's just going to hope they can come up with something to flesh it out and make it actually kind of work. But Hughes is actually correct. There isn't a plan in there. The fact that Gavotte likes parties and glamour and the high life doesn't mean he's going to show up just because Neil and the FBI throw a party. I mean, it's Fashion Week. There are probably lots of parties being thrown all over town, all of them with a lot of models. So why would Gavotte go to this party instead of some other party? I would think that in a situation like this, somebody like Gavotte would be interested in a number of things. First of all, where's the party? If it's at a place that is beneath him, he's not going to go, no matter who's there. He's going to be interested in who is there. If it's a party that's got nobody of importance or, you know, anybody that appeals to him, he's not going to go. And would also be concerned about who is throwing the party. Because if it's a nobody throwing the party, it doesn't matter that it's in a nice place or it's going to have some interesting people. It's a party being thrown by a nobody. Why would he go? So why would Gavotte go to this party instead of some other party? There's no real good answer to that because there is no answer to that. And that's because it really isn't the plan. It's just an excuse to have a party, I think. They're taking a shot at it and hoping for the best, hoping that there's something about this party that will get his attention and cause him to come to this party instead of some other party. Despite all the reasons why this so-called plan isn't a plan and why this so-called plan isn't going to work or is very unlikely to work, Hughes authorizes the party with a minimal budget. And so to help make it work within their budget, Neil volunteers Elizabeth to help with the party because she is an event planner. So they grab Elizabeth and they go to a warehouse full of seized goods and property and try to come up with some things that they can use at the party.
Wow, Royal Ocetra Caviar. Ooh, Neil, I just found Springbank.
Whiskey, perfect. I got a Garioch Scotch over here.
65?
No, 58.
Oh, grab the case.
All right, come on, we gotta itemize all this. 12 bottles of Scotch.
36 tins of Ocetra.
Blues and fish eggs, you got that?
Yeah.
Whoa. Drop the watch, convict. We're not on a shopping spree.
No, it wasn't for me. It was for you.
Oh, thank you. But there's nothing wrong with my old watch.
Honey, actually, that looks great on you.
A little out of my price range.
Okay, so we've got the alcohol and the food covered. Now we just need the venue.
Don't worry. I got that covered.
Now, I'm not sure how kosher it is to use seized goods, which are presumably evidence in other cases and something like this. But, you know, it's the government, so you never know. But they find Royal Ocetra Caviar, which, as I priced it here recently, is about $120 an ounce. Springbank Whiskey, which, depending on the type and age, ranges in price from about $70 to $2,000 a bottle. And the 58 Garioch Scotch sells for about $3,500 a bottle. And Peter flippantly calls them booze and fish eggs. Peter clearly is not impressed with the trappings of wealth. During this search for goods to use at the party, Neil finds a watch that he admires, and he tries to cover it by saying, "Oh, you know, I'm looking at it for you, Peter. Yeah, that's the story, and I'm sticking to it." I think it's pretty obvious he was looking at it for himself, but Peter put the kibosh on that. Then they have to discuss the venue. And when Peter says, "Hey, I've got that covered," Neil and Elizabeth look at each other, and the look they give each other is sort of a, this isn't going to be good look. They know that Peter isn't particularly imaginative and has a different set of standards, and his standards don't fit the stylish high roller attitude that they really need for this party. And when he reveals what he's got for the party, Neil's not impressed. It's a loft. A loft that was used in a crime and may even still have the chalk outline of the deceased drawn on the floor. But that's not a problem because Neil comes up with something. It's actually a place that a friend of his owns. Now, at this point, the only friend of Neil's that we know of is Mozzie. I think we can probably rule out Mozzie being the owner of this property, because it's out of character for a guy who is as paranoid about the government as he is, and whoever else he's paranoid about. And owning a place like this is hardly the way to keep off the radar. I think we can bet that it's not Mozzie who owns it, but it does leave a question out there as to who does own it and what Neil's relationship to them is. Interestingly enough, when Elizabeth sees the space that Neil has secured for the party, she thinks that Peter came up with it because he had said he was going to. But the interesting part is that Neil lets Peter take the credit. Now, is he trying to get on Peter's good side? Is he thinking that at some point in the future, if he needs to ask a favor, such as something involving his hunt for Kate, that Peter will be more receptive if he lets him take the credit? Now, this would be the type of thing that would be in character for Neil. But we know that Peter talks to Elizabeth about his cases. He probably tells her most of what happens. And I would think that Neil would have a pretty good idea that that's the case as well. So wouldn't he suspect that at some point Peter would tell Elizabeth that it was really Neil who found the venue? So I'm not sure what Neil's motivation here is for letting Peter take the credit. I'm going to think that it's in large part simply trying to get on Peter's good side for some thing in the future. And it is here that Neil meets Agent Lauren Cruz. Now, she is not impressed with him, and he makes that even worse by going for the cheap joke about where does she keep her gun. The joke clearly does not go down well with her. Later that evening, the party is going on. Neil is with Tara, and they are working the area trying to pick up something in somebody's voice that will spark her identification of that individual. During the course of the party, Tara does hear somebody speaking in Hebrew, and that's their first clue that they're kind of on the right path and that Gavotte may be there somewhere. Now, this is where things go wrong, because Neil doesn't stick to the plan. The plan was to have Tara walk around, listen to people's voices, and identify their suspect. But Neil tries to improvise. He tries to take a shortcut. And what he does is he steals the phone out of the pocket of the individual that they heard speaking, presumably to Gavotte. Now, they know that the individual that they heard talking on the phone was not their suspect. But Neil's plan seems to be, or his improvisation seems to be, that if he can get the guy's phone, he can dial Gavotte's phone from that using the redial function, and they can identify Gavotte. But Gavotte either anticipates Neil's action, or he's paranoid enough that he wants to get rid of the phone that he was using, so he dumps it into somebody else's pocket. The result is that when Neil uses the redial function on the phone that he swiped to dial Gavotte's phone, it does ring Gavotte's phone, but it's not in Gavotte's pocket. And as a result of Neil's careless improvisation and failure to stick to the plan, they identify the wrong person, and Gavotte gets away. After the party and the bust goes wrong, we see Neil back at his apartment with Mozzie.
Man with the ring was with Kate in California. You tell me what he wants from her, because he didn't find what he was looking for in San Diego.
How do you know what he was looking for?
Because I told Kate I kept everything, the money, the bonds, the art, all of it in San Diego.
Well, clearly that's not the truth, because you told me it was all hidden in Portland, isn't it? There's nothing hidden in either place, is there? It's a test.
Look, I just needed to know what I already knew.
What, that you can trust me?
Oz.
That I'm the one who's been there through all of it? But Kate's the one who kicked over your rock.
We know that Mozzie's been a very, very good friend to Neil. We saw that in the first episode of the pilot. And so I think Mozzie is Neil's best friend and his partner in crime. They have a relationship that transcends mere partnership. And so he's offended when he discovers that Neil lied to him about all of this. And he says, you know, I was there. I was always the person you could trust. And Kate is the one who betrayed you. Neil comes up with an interesting, let me say, illogical response to that. And he says that Kate didn't betray me. He forced her to. Neil apparently doesn't understand the meaning of the word betray, because it doesn't matter whether it's voluntary or under coercion. The fact is, she betrayed Neil. She told the man, the unidentified man, the man with the ring, the man in San Diego who was with Kate, or who Kate was with, she told him that Neil had told her that all of the stuff that he had stored was in San Diego. So she betrayed him, but he doesn't want to see that. Now, he does think that maybe Kate tried to warn him about what was happening, either before she betrayed him or afterwards. He thinks that she tried to warn him during her last visit at the prison. Neil tries to support his contention that Kate may have warned him by showing Mozzie an old love letter, which Mozzie begins to read.
Weep for me, my love. I'll miss you more. What is this?
It's just an old love letter. It doesn't mean anything, okay? But the FBI was closing in on us. We started taking precautions. We started passing codes.
That could be cracked by anyone who's ever seen the back of Mad Magazine.
Okay, you know, you ask me why I don't tell you certain things. Is that attitude?
I'm trying to be supportive.
The code that Neil is referring to in this, of course, is the fold-in gag that was used in the Mad Magazine and cracked and a few others in the past. And Mozzie isn't impressed. And of course, Neil says, well, but look, this was an early attempt. But the point is, she was trying to warn me. Because we were passing codes, and our codes got better as time went on, and there must have been something there. I don't know what it was, but there must have been. And so Mozzie suggests, well, you know, your friend from the FBI has a videotape of that last meeting. You could ask him for it, which is kind of an interesting admission from Mozzie that, you know, sometimes the FBI can be useful even for our own purposes, beyond just their regular job of enforcing the law. So it's quite a step for Mozzie to even suggest that to Neil. Well, presumably the next day they're having a meeting between Peter, Lauren, and Neil. Lauren brings them up to date on their identity of the ghost and also gives a little bit of background information on their other suspect, Dimitri. The meeting concludes, and then there's a little conversation between Neil and Lauren.
Nice report.
Thanks.
You know, pull off the whole FBI thing, too.
Yeah, no one looks good in FBI slacks.
Don't sell yourself short.
Better.
You sure? Was it a little too direct? Or...
Yeah, but I like where you're going with it.
Now, clearly, Neil is initiating the flirtation, but Lauren does seem to respond to it, at least after her initial coolness, because she does say, hey, you know, no, you weren't too forward. I like where you were going with that. But she doesn't seem to be all that enamored with Neil at the moment. That may change, but she hasn't been impressed with him up to this point. She finishes up the conversation and leaves. Peter is in his office getting ready to meet Elizabeth for lunch, and Neil asks him about the tape.
Hey, Peter, before you go, I need a favor. The last time Kate visited me in prison before she disappeared, you saw that security tape?
Yeah.
I'd like to see it.
You think that's a good idea?
It's the last time I saw her. I just want some closure.
Now, Neil presents it very well to Peter. It comes off as a very sincere request that, it, you know, it's the last time he saw her. He just wants to see the tape again for closure. But as Peter's walking out of the room, you see a little bit of a grin, a very slight grin, cross Neil's face. And it's almost the kind of grin that says, I did it. Got away with it. He bought it. So he's definitely not in it for the closure. Peter has his lunch with Elizabeth, and she says, you know, I saw you looking at that watch at the warehouse the other day. Well, he really wasn't. Neil was looking at it and used Peter as a cover. And so she presents him with a watch, a very fancy watch that, you know, really isn't Peter, but she obviously feels that she's getting him something that he would like and appreciate. But he doesn't seem to be able to read it. He can't tell what time it is from the watch. And he tries to make the best of it, but it's obviously he's not real comfortable with that watch because it's just not his style. Because again, he's a booze and fish eggs guy. He's not a Garrick scotch and caviar kind of guy. He just isn't the high-end individual that watch is designed for. While Peter is still at lunch, Neil meets up with Tara and discovers she's going into witness protection. Peter returns and they head out to meet with Dimitri. There's a little bit of humor between Neil and Peter as Peter tries to pretend to be a tough guy bodyguard, you know, with the dark glasses and such as that. And then there's a little bit of sparring between Neil and Dimitri. Dimitri tries to warn off Neil, and Neil kind of plays dumb a little bit. And then Dimitri basically ends the conversation and gives a signal to his bodyguard to come over and kind of muscle Neil and Peter out. Now, to me, the interesting little bit in this is that when he walks toward Neil and Dimitri, his motions, his actions, his movements, he looks like a model on a runway showing off the clothes that he's wearing. He doesn't look and move like a bodyguard. Now, a short time later, Dimitri is murdered, and Peter, Neil, and Jones are on the scene, and they discover a slit in the dress that is there at the scene that is about the size that you would need to extract a security strip. So they've got a clue now as to what the point of interest is for Gavotte. After this, Peter interviews the fashion designer of the dress, who tells Peter about the kidnapping of his son and that kidnapping being used as leverage to allow himself to be used to transport whatever this thing was inside of one of his dresses. And they also learn that the dress that was at the scene was a second dress, a copy dress, or a backup dress, and that the real dress, the dress with the whatever it was, the dress that Gavotte was actually after, was still in Yvette's possession. So now they have the security strip. They have the dress that Gavotte wants because of the security strip that was hidden inside of it. And so Peter comes up with the idea of using Tara as bait to draw out Gavotte.
Hello.
I recognize you from the party.
Who is this?
I saw you steal Dimitri's phone.
Yeah, I was trying to eliminate the competition. Guess it worked.
So you know what you have?
I know exactly what I got.
You paid $50,000 for the dress. I'll give you $5 million.
My fiancé loves it so much. How about we make it 10?
Do you know who you're talking to?
This is Steve, right?
I tried to be nice. I tried to give you a choice.
So we see that Neil was offered $5 million from Gavotte for the dress, and then he doubles the price. And of course, Gavotte isn't happy. I wonder if Neil didn't again go off script and ruin the plan by trying to improvise. Now, we don't know exactly what Peter's original plan was, but the whole point of the plan was to draw Gavotte out. I'm not sure that killing the deal by trying to double the offered price was part of the plan, because that doesn't seem to be a tactic that would have a chance of succeeding. That would seem to be counterproductive. So again, it seems to be a case of Neil going off script and trying to improvise. And the result is that Gavotte takes Tara hostage. Now, I think that we can surmise that this was not part of Peter's original plan. Now, we don't know exactly what Peter's plan was, but if Peter's original plan was to have Tara kidnapped and used as a hostage, first of all, that would be a very bad plan. And second of all, we know that he sent Tara home with agents guarding her, which suggests that it was not part of Peter's plan to endanger her in any way by trying to get her kidnapped. Yes, using her as bait was a little bit of an endangerment, but he didn't necessarily want her to be kidnapped. So I think we can safely say that Neil went off plan, and as a result, Tara was kidnapped, being held for ransom, and the ransom being the dress with the electronic security strip in it. Now, Neil seems to recognize his responsibility in the kidnapping of Tara, but he gets his facts wrong.
You have to let me go to the exchange. It's my fault Tara's in trouble. I'm the one who paraded her around town in that dress.
The best thing you can do is help me figure out what Gavotte's game plan is. He knows we're going to have the place staked out.
He knows you're running your playbook.
Christ, we're going to toss the old one, come up with a new one.
No, you don't. That's the point. See, he's counting on the FBI to have a plan.
So I do nothing.
Roll with it.
Like you would.
He expects you to have a plan. don't have one.
Well, that's the worst idea ever.
Prepare all you can, just know it's all gonna change.
What would you do?
I go home and have dinner with my wife.
Neil seems to take the blame for the kidnapping because he was taking Tara out, showing her around, showing her off, and using her as bait. Except that's not why she was kidnapped. She was kidnapped because he doubled the price. Had he accepted the $5 million offer, as I'm sure was the original intent and plan that Peter had, they would have just simply arranged to swap the dress for the money. Granted, they would have set something up so that they could have caught Gavotte. They would not have to be out the money. But pushing Gavotte to kidnap Tara couldn't have possibly have been the original plan. So Neil's right that he's responsible, but he's got the reason wrong. Now, Peter asks him what he should do because Gavotte knows they're going to be waiting for him. Neil says, don't plan it, just wing it, which is Neil's solution, it seems, to everything. Now, in this particular case, there might be some validity to that, not to the extent that Neil suggests, but certainly to the extent that they need to realize that whatever their plan is, they're going to have to be flexible, and it's probably going to go a different direction than what they've planned for. So they probably want to plan for various other contingencies. Now, what those are, nobody knows at this point, but at least have given some thought to all the different ways that they imagine it could go and be prepared to go one of these alternate routes or, again, maybe wing it, but not entirely. Next, we have a scene between Peter and Elizabeth, and it's a scene that really reveals the kind of relationship that Peter and Elizabeth have.
You meet this guy in Central Park, and you give him the dress, and he gives you the girl.
That's about the size of it.
I'm really glad you got into the white-collar crime division where nothing exciting happens.
It's pretty dull stuff.
Yeah. I got you another present.
Honey, not another one. I'm enjoying my first one. Don't. It's my old watch. But I love my new one.
Come on, honey. It's big. It's clunky. It moves around your wrist. And I mean, it's beautiful, but it's not you. Take this. I need you to be Agent Peter Burke tomorrow. And this is you. Besides, when all this is over with, I need you home at 6 o'clock, right on the dot.
Thank you.
Now, the thing I think this reveals about Elizabeth and Peter is that Elizabeth, at some level, wants to elevate Peter from where he's at. He's the meat and potatoes guy, or the meatloaf and potatoes guy. He's not the steak and caviar and, you know, the high-end guy. He's not the guy that fits the watch that she gave him. There's a part of her that wants him to be that, but she realizes that it's more important for her to accept him as who he is and for him to be who he is, which is why she gives him the watch back and says, you know, that watch I gave you, that's not you. This is you, and this is who I need you to be. And then, of course, I think there's a really nice callback to the pilot episode where they were in that meeting and he forgot to go home for dinner. And I think that's what this reference to, I need you to be home at 6 o'clock for dinner, it is about. I think that's a callback to that. So again, a nice scene between Peter and Elizabeth. Next, Hughes is holding a briefing. This would be the next day, outlining what's going to happen in this exchange with Gavotte.
And Gavotte wants the dress because it's been tagged with a security device. We cracked the thread this morning. It's holding the holographic code of the latest European currency seal. Using a counterfeit code, we're hoping he won't be able to tell the difference, but if he does, this could go south fast.
We're putting this girl's life at risk.
We could put the entire monetary system of Europe at risk. Guess who wins? I'll be running point. We'll have eyes in the air, plain clothes on the ground. Cruz, Jones, you're with me. Burke, you know what you got to do. Caffrey, put your hand down. Put it down.
I'm just wondering where I'll be.
On a coffee run. You're not even supposed to be here.
Now, there's quite a few interesting things about this briefing. First of all is the fact that Neil is like an eager school kid trying to ingratiate himself with this teacher, wanting to know what important thing he's going to do. Hughes clearly has issues with Caffrey being involved in their investigations. And like a teacher scolding a nuisance student, he tells Neil to put his hand down and he's going to be on a coffee run. He's going to be out of the way doing something where he isn't going to be bothering them. So you know that Hughes just is not happy with Neil for whatever reason. He clearly has a problem with Caffrey being involved in this investigation, or at least at this point in the investigation, and perhaps even because he is responsible for Tara being kidnapped and them being in this situation at all. After Hughes scolds Neil, Lauren Cruz gives Neil a sympathetic look. It's almost as if she feels a bit sorry for Neil being shut out of the plan and for the way Hughes is treating him. So that's interesting because earlier when she was in the office with Neil and Neil was trying to flirt with her, she was pretty resistant. She has obviously up to this point not been that impressed with Neil, but here she seems to genuinely have a feeling of a sympathy for him. Now, an interesting point that comes up during the briefing is it's an acknowledgement of the manner in which an operation like this can result in civilian deaths. And of course, this is highlighted after Hughes advises the team about the contents of the encoded data on the strip and says that they've replaced the real code with a counterfeit code and that they're hoping that Gavotte can't tell the difference. But if he does, it could go south fast. Now, Peter says, hey, we're putting this girl's life at risk. And Hughes says, it's that or the entire monetary system of Europe. Guess who wins? Guess who loses? Now, that seems a rather cold attitude, but first of all, Hughes did not create this situation. He's simply trying to deal with it. He's trying to deal with it the best way he can, but as the person in charge, he is responsible for making a decision, and that decision is, what is the greater risk? And it's not that he's wanting Tara to be a casualty. It's just that he's understanding that it could happen, and he's letting the team know we don't have a choice in this matter. It's out of our hands. It's bigger than us. Guess who wins? Neil can't stand not being involved. He crashes the stakeout. He crashes the scene and busts in uninvited into the stakeout van. Now, as the situation unfolds, Gavotte, of course, shows up with Tara. She's wrapped up in a bomb-type rig, which he says he can activate with his cell phone. Neil decides to improvise, and in keeping with his act-first-think-about-it-later approach, he tells everybody to start calling Gavotte's phone, jam it, and then he takes off to confront Gavotte. When he catches up with Gavotte, he holds up his cell phone for Gavotte to see, as if to say, hey, look, I'm the one who's been jamming your phone. I've outsmarted you. And this is Neil just showing off. And, of course, it backfires because Gavotte pulls a gun on him. It's sort of a rock, paper, scissors moment. Rock breaks scissors, gun blows a hole in the cell phone, not to mention the person holding it. And it's only because Cruz comes up behind Gavotte and takes him down that Neil manages to get out of it alive. Granted, he knew that Lauren and the other agents were nearby, and there was a chance that they would be able to take Gavotte down before things got bad for him, but there was an equal chance that it could have gone a different way. Very reminiscent of his actions in the pilot where he confronted Hagen without any backup actually being there and the hope that they would get there in time. So again, Neil not planning, just trying to improvise and putting a lot of things at risk. And then in what seems to be an attempt to impress Peter and maybe get an attaboy from Peter, especially after he sees Peter doing the whole hero thing of grabbing Tara and throwing her to the ground and covering her with his body in case the belt that they've removed from her blows up, Neil tries to take credit for taking Gavotte down with, as he says, a leg sweep. even though it was actually Lauren Cruz who took him down. It's generally, I wouldn't think, a good idea to alienate somebody who, at the very least, seems sympathetic to your situation by taking credit for their work. Because Lauren did seem to be sympathetic toward Neil during their briefing. But now he basically stabs her in the back by trying to take credit for her work. And if he was going to flirt with her and he's trying to get in good with her, or he's just trying to score some points with her, this is not the way to do it. So he took what could have been a developing, I'm not going to say possible romantic relationship, but at least a developing relationship, even if it's just a matter of building a good work relationship, he took that and put it at risk by trying to take credit for her work. Not a good move. Next, we see Neil and Mozzie back in Neil's apartment, watching the videotape of that final meeting between Neil and Kate in the prison.
It was nice of your FBI friend to give you this.
Shh.
There's no sound. Why are you shushing me? Does she always wear her hair parted that way?
Yeah, way past that. Her scarf is forming the letter M.
13th letter in the alphabet. 13 is a prime.
Thanks, Rain Man.
Do you want my help?
There it is. There it is. How's your Morse code?
B O double T L E.
Wow.
Mozzie just can't keep quiet. He keeps intruding on Neil's concentration. And of course, Neil shushes him, and Mozzie takes exception to it. Mozzie really comes across here as a kid who just doesn't know what's going on, but wants to help, which is kind of a reflection of Neil's behavior back during Hughes's briefing. And so he says things that are either completely obvious, as if they are some great revelation that only he saw, or he says things that are just pointlessly trivial or just nonsense because he doesn't have a clue about what's actually going on or what Neil's looking for. So it's kind of a humorous little scene, but it ends up with them discovering that Kate wants Neil to look at the bottle. There's something about the bottle that is important. And there is where we leave the episode. If you would like to connect with the show, you can reach us at whitecolloredpc.com. I will be providing links for resources on the website. And from there, you can also find the various ways to contact me. If you are at all enjoying the show, or at least you don't find it totally distasteful, please subscribe so that when new episodes come out, you will be notified. And also tell a friend. I want to thank you for listening and ask you to join me on the next episode as I share my thoughts on Book of Hours. Until then, take care and God bless.